everyone. Thank you for joining us. I'm here again with Shelley Aldridge and our guest, Jan Moyer, to talk about projects in landscape lighting. Jan, you've done a ton of projects. It would take an hour just to go through the list of them. But tell us about a project that struck you as something, a challenge or an interesting project that you remember doing, and what was the process of that project?
One of the projects that really changed my career was the Chicago Botanic Garden. I got asked to bid on that project against some well-known lighting designers, and I was selected, which was really great. And I brought an entire team to work on it. We were doing the lighting for an island that you could see from another part of the Chicago Botanic Garden, and sometimes you could be on the island. And there were a lot of challenges. Getting power over there was a challenge because the gardens were all completed. It was in Chicago, and so the county was in charge of it, and they're a very, very restrictive county. So we had to jump through all kinds of hoops. And on top of that, we had to present the whole idea to the board of directors and have them approve it. And then we went directly from conceptual design into construction, which is a little bit odd. So there was a lot of weird things about it. One of the things that I think was most important was thinking about creating a cohesive composition from across a lake. So you're sitting on one piece of land, looking across a lake to this island, and there was a Carillon Tower on the island. And so people would come to the Chicago Botanic Garden at night to listen to the bell concerts. So I felt it was really important, as I always do, to have a cohesive composition across the entire scene that we were lighting. And there was a huge challenge in that the entire middle of the island was just grasses. And back in the very back of the island, there were a couple of trees, but it wasn't enough to connect your eye from left to right. And of course, the Carillon Tower was over on the right-hand side, and that was the thing that you really wanted to pay attention to, but the whole thing had to work together. So I came up with a new technique, and I call it shore scraping. And what happens is you actually put the fixtures in the water of the lake and you shine back at the shore. So I was grazing the entire length of the grasses and I was cross angling the fixtures. And that was the first time I'd ever done that. And I've now done that several times since. And a lot of people that have learned from me are using that technique as well.
Wow, that's complicated. And
it was complicated. And part of the complication was we had to make sure that we could control the level of the lake. And we could do that until there was a storm. And so we had to install a shutoff mechanism for all the fixtures, not just the ones that were in the lake, but all the ones up on the shore as well, if the lake flooded. And so that became a standard in all of my projects where I'm working around big lakes, of which there turned out to be more than one.
Right. So that was the big learning experience. It sounds like by experiential, having the level of the lake change, and how do you respond to that?
Yeah. Oh, and then the other thing is lighting using the shore scraping technique, where we're cross lighting. In this case, you don't always cross light, but in this case, we were the shoreline. If people were allowed on the island, the shore scraping couldn't be on because there was no way to shield it from glare. It was glare from across the lake looking from the other location. It was beautiful, but so we had a very simple control system. If the paths, there were two paths going onto the island, if the paths were open, the shore scraping was off, but the paths were never open when there was a Carillon concert. So that helped make it work.
Oh, wow.
The details.
Right. And is that still intact? Is that,
yep.
Okay, so it's still happening today.
Yep. And one of the things that I always try and do when I'm working on a remote project like the Chicago Botanic Garden, at that time I lived in New York, now we live in Arizona, there's really no difference. I'm not there. So we found a local lighting person in Chicago that has been maintaining it.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Interesting. That's really interesting. Okay, and you are, I don't know how many women there are in landscape lighting, but for a long time, you were the only one that anybody knew of in landscape lighting, a woman in landscape lighting. How has being a woman operated business and a woman owned business, how has that helped you, and or how has that been a disadvantage?
You know, it's been more of a disadvantage than an advantage, because I was working in a man's world. And, you know, when I first wrote the landscape lighting book, the first book that I wrote that book because of corrosion. So we're back now in the 1980s. And I kept asking everybody that I knew, all the manufacturers, all the experts in lighting, about corrosion, and no one knew anything. And they would say to me, and I'm not kidding, they would say, oh, you don't need to know about that, dear. Like, you know, little girl, you don't need to know that. We'll take care of that. Well, I don't believe that that's okay. I believe that if I'm going to specify something and ask you to spend a ton of money to install it, I've got to know that it's going to work. Mm-hmm. So I always brought these disadvantages to an advantage. I wrote the landscape lighting book because of that chapter. And the landscape lighting book made me famous worldwide. I became the person that you went to if you wanted to know something about landscape lighting. And that happened before the book even came out, because everybody was talking about it, which was great. I couldn't have done better marketing than what happened. So those kinds of challenges, I ran into them constantly, and I still do. Still, even though when people understand who I am, then they'll back off. But if they don't know who I am, they treat me like, oh, you little girl. And, you know, I thought when I got to be as old as I am that they would stop doing that. But it's a woman thing. You know, we deal with that in lighting and in all parts of architectural construction.
Right. That's true.
It's so great to see more women getting involved in lighting, for sure.
But and there are so many women involved in landscape lighting now. I'm really proud of all the women that I know of that are doing landscape lighting and doing beautiful work. Do you guys know about the gal in Athens? I can't remember her last name. Her first name is Eleftheria. And she just finished, within the last 2 years, she just finished relighting the Acropolis.
Oh,
no.
She did a beautiful job.
Wow, that is a job. I mean,
that's a job. Yeah,
that is the job almost. You know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. Oh, interesting. No, we didn't know about her. That's fascinating. So
I'm definitely gonna look her up.
Yeah,
we're gonna look her up. Of course, and we have to. We'll have to.
It'd be great if you could get her on your program.
We would love that.
She speaks English.
Speaks English, okay. And then, because we don't speak Greek.
I speak Greek, but
do you? Okay.
There aren't many, and I say that lightly because I haven't used Greek in a long time, so I would have to brush up. I can remember how to ask to borrow your donkey, which is not something that I normally use in my day-to-day life.
People probably don't use that very often in their day-to-day life, but it's great. It's a great little catchphrase to know, but we know that you have worked with a lot of on big projects and small projects, and I think that consumers are really, end users, I'll say, homeowners or the end user is often paralyzed by landscape lighting because they don't even know where to start. They don't know how to light the space. But they know that they want lighting in their yard, in their front yard, their garden. Are there any sort of basic essentials that are on your list for the small projects or the consumer? What would you tell them about landscape lighting?
Let me first say that I believe everybody should have good landscape lighting, even if it's just in your local park, because it's so wonderful to enjoy the night. And in all three of the areas that we're in right now, isn't it wonderful to be out at night?
Yes.
That's going to change soon for me. It'll be too hot. And you, in some areas, it might be too humid. And but being able to enjoy the night it shouldn't be a luxury. It should be something that we can all have at our hands. And so it doesn't take much. It doesn't take much light output because it's dark. You know, it's all the walls are gone. We just have this dark globe over us. So it doesn't take much light in terms of the amount of wattage or the candle power, but it also doesn't take much in terms of fixtures. I have a mantra that says use more fixtures and less wattage, but that's to show three-dimensional qualities of whatever you're lighting. But starting from the global perspective, it just doesn't take much. I have a friend in New York. I sent her one light fixture to light a part of her tree out her front window because she's disabled and she sits in her sofa a lot all day long and all night, and she wanted to be able to see out her window. And so sometimes it only takes one fixture. So the thing that I would say to someone that's looking at doing landscape lighting and doesn't know, and it's not surprising, it's both a left and right brain thing. We've got to know both the technical and the design to make it work. Mm-hmm. So expecting anybody to understand it, I mean, even interior lighting designers don't really understand landscape lighting. So how could just a normal person that wants some landscape lighting for their front yard or the backyard? And before I go into the rules, let me just talk about the difference between front and backyard. In most people's properties, front yard has to do with the street view. In Right. most people's properties, backyard has to do with your enjoyment of the property. So what I think is more important between those two is the backyard. But some people want to do the front yard and they'll only do one or the other. And you know, it's up to them what we do for them. So then going back to the rules, what you want to do is think about how you're going to use the space. Let's say you don't use your landscape right now. Think about how you might use it if you could use it, if you had landscape. What would you do? And some of the things to think about are you looking out your kitchen window while you're doing your dishes out into your backyard? Are you looking out the dining room window? Are you looking out your living room window? Are you looking out your bedroom window? How do you experience the landscape from inside the house? Because we can make the house feel bigger by including the landscape in what we light. And then how would you use it outside? Do you have an overhang and a table? So you might have cocktails, or you might have dinner, or you might just have friends come over and chat or play games. So do you need task lighting at the table? That's something that I don't really think of as landscape lighting. It's really more of general lighting, but it's certainly part of landscape lighting if that's important. And then the thing to think about is that we're vertical animals. So we see vertical spaces before we see horizontal. So what that means is hedges and trees and sculptures and fountains and walls are more important than pathways and patios, the stuff that's down below us. I'm not saying it's not important, but the other stuff is more important. So think about one thing at least. Is it a water feature? Is it a beautiful tree? Is it a beautiful sculpture? Is it your back wall? What is it that we could start with? And as we're building a composition, all of the elements, I break any composition into multiple elements. What's the most important, then the second most important, the third most important, and it can go on as far as you want to take it. Usually there's at least three, the foreground, the midground, and the background. And the general rule in landscape lighting is that if you want to increase a sense of depth in the space, then the background has to be the brightest. And generally speaking, then the foreground should be the second brightest, because the light levels of the interior are typically so much higher than landscape lighting levels, that we have to make the transition from the higher levels to the lower levels. And that means that the mid-ground is generally the least important. Then the next thing I think that's really important to think about in landscape lighting is controlling the brightness of fixtures. In any environment, the brightest element is always going to be the thing that your eye goes to first, because we are always attracted to brightness. So if you have sconces or a hanging fixture or post-top fixtures or bollards or landscape lighting fixtures that you can see the brightness of the lamp, you have glare, and that will tear your composition apart. So you need to shield the light sources in every light fixture that you use. Now, I'm going to leave out all the decorative fixtures, which I include the sconces and the hanging fixtures or the decorative fixtures and the bollards and the path lights. I'm going to leave all of them out for the moment and just talk about landscape lighting fixtures. We need to have enough shielding of the light source. And with LED, that has become more difficult because many manufacturers have their LED chip right at the base of the fixture. And so you can't use the fixture itself to shield it. You want to make sure, even in that case, that you can put in a louver, because a louver will give you 45 degree shielding off angle from the fixture. And you've got to get really up close to the fixture to get into that beyond the 45 degree shielding, which you can do. But in normal viewing of fixtures, 45 degrees will shield most of your direct view of the lamp. But what that doesn't do is shield the inside of the fixture. You need to have a glare shield for that. And I like an angled glare shield. So it's shaped like this, and it only shields from some viewing directions. So if you're sitting at a table looking out into the garden, you have the shield so that it's blocking the fixture. So this is the shield and the light fixture is in here. So that glare shield will block the glare. There are times when you can walk all the way around a garden and there will be some parts in the middle that you can't shield. In that case, I tend to try and use below grade fixtures because they will produce less glare, and you can put either a grate over them or a half glare shield. So then what's next in terms of importance? Okay, let me talk next about this brightness level that I talked about, that interior levels are brighter than the exterior levels. Typically, interior levels are between, in a home I'm talking about, just a home, not an office or a business, it's between 10 to 20 foot candles. The general light level that we use in landscape lighting is between a quarter of a foot candle, typically a quarter of a foot candle, maybe up to 3/4 of a foot candle. And when we're accenting something, we might go all the way up to between 2 and 5 foot candles. So even at that brightness, the 5 foot candles, we're still half to a quarter of the interior lighting. So we've got to think about dimming. If you want to be inside looking out, you've got to have the landscape lighting at least as bright as the interior. So, and if you're going to be outside, you don't want the landscape lighting as bright as the inside, because it's just going to feel too bright. So there's several ways to think about this. And the way I like to think about it first is be able to dim the interior lighting so that you don't have to dim the landscape lighting, so that it can always be just beautiful. That doesn't always work. So there are times when you need to be able to dim the landscape lighting separately from the interior lighting. And I'd say in all the projects I do, it's maybe a 5 or 10% rate that I think we need to have dimming. And the reason that I want to limit the dimming is because, as you guys know, dimming adds a huge cost to lighting. If you've got a whole house system already and you've already paid for that infrastructure, then adding landscape lighting won't be that expensive. And if you're just adding dimming onto transformers in the landscape lighting, it doesn't have to be that expensive. But we've got to be careful about it and think about it. Whew. Is that enough?
Well, I was curious. I was taught, and I wonder if this is still true. You know, like you were saying, the perimeter or the furthest distance should be the brightest. when you're inside, you're having entertaining. Isn't that what helps carry you through the space? Like if it's not lit back there and you're just, some people will just light around their porch. It's like it works as a screen and you don't see any further than the back porch or whatever you want to call it.
It works as a boundary. So it gives you depth and it gives you privacy. But if you don't want to do that, I've done many windows where, for example, in someone's kitchen in Berkeley, California, I lit a tree fern right outside that window and that was it. All you saw was the tree fern. So I had, if this was the window and here was the tree fern, and there was maybe only a couple of feet between them, I had the fixture here right at the window shining at the tree fern.
Right.
So you can just light one thing and make a connection so that at least you have a connection to the landscape, or you can open up the whole view by lighting the boundary and some parts of everything in between.
Right. Do you still, I remember learning from you that you used to love to shine down for the moonlight effect in trees. Do you still suggest, I did that in my own home because of learning from you. Do you recommend that?
Yes. Yeah. I've got to say a bunch of things about that. I don't call it moonlighting.
Okay.
Because the color of moonlighting is very blue and we look like ghosts under blue light. So I want us to think of it as the dappled light that you see when you're walking through a forest and the sunlight is coming through. So I start my thinking on every project with downlighting. There are some places where you can't do downlighting. There are no trees, there are no buildings, there's no trellis. There's no place to do downlighting from, but I always start my thinking that way. And I do that because downlighting looks the most natural. If you've got fixtures up above your head mounted in a tree or a structure, the downlight fixture can cover more territory than any fixture at the ground can cover, unless it's shining up into the canopy of a tree. Mm-hmm. So we get a lot more coverage. We can light paths using downlighting and never actually light the path. And I try to never light paths. I use downlighting to light the things around the path, or uplighting if I have to, if that can work, and that's a little trickier. And there are times when there is no place to do downlighting, so I actually have to use path lights, and then I want a completely shielded path light. Mm-hmm. And that's just, you know, the tip of the iceberg I'm talking about path lights. But back to downlighting, I'm not done with the benefits of it. Wherever you put the fixture, that's where the fixture is going to stay forever. As the tree grows, trees grow out this way, and they grow from the very tip of their branch, they grow out. But this location never changes. So one of the great things about downlighting is that it's a lot less maintenance to your scene than anything else. And when you think, okay, yeah, but we've got to do maintenance. When you have your pruners come to do any pruning on your trees, have them just do whatever maintenance needs to be done to the landscape lighting at that time. And obviously you or your representative will need to work with them to make sure they know what to do. You can't expect an arborist to know what to do unless they were the arborist that did the installation. And I'm always working with arborists to do installations. So downlighting is my go-to place. I just love it.
So going back to it, we don't call it moonlighting because it's a little too blue, but now that we're in this LED strip, you know, category, and we may have talked about this the last episode and I may have missed it. What Kelvin are you using mostly outside? Still 3000?
I use primarily 3000 when I'm outside. And that's because of how beautiful it makes all the colors of the flowers and how beautiful it makes the foliage. It's not so good on trunks. They like warmer color temperatures, but I think that's a reasonable, I'm giving up that one part, which is a less important part than the flowers and the canopies and the leaves on the plants. I do use 2700 when I'm lighting a white wall or a cream colored wall. Or a light colored wall that's not, you know, a color, it's some neutral color, and pathways that are neutral colors, like warm stone colors. And I don't find that there's any problem with that in terms of the two working together. And I have sometimes thought about, for example, on redwood trees, lighting the trunks with 2,700 because it just doesn't look as good with 3,000.
Right. That makes sense. Okay.
But on the other hand, I want you to know that for me, and this is always dependent on who the client is, for me, in my house, I use 2,700 because I like the warmth better. I have a warm color palette in my house. My really good friend, Naomi Miller, who you probably know about, she's an architectural lighting designer. She has a cool color house and she uses 3,000 in her house.
Right. It's very
important. And either one can work.
Right. That makes sense.
So you are okay if you have a redwood tree lighting the trunk 2,700, even if you and having 3,000 in other parts of the garden.
Even on just the canopy of the redwood tree. Usually the canopy of the redwood tree is way high up above. So it's usually two separate elements that make up one thing. But yeah, it's the redwood trunk is just going to look so beautiful in 2,700. And it's just going to look kind of okay in 3,000.
Interesting. We have redwood trees on our property. And
you've got to go play with it and see.
I'm going to have to. And I'm embarrassed to say that we have no landscape lighting in our house right now. We have no land. We're digging up our whole garden. So there's nothing outside. It's actually frightening.
It'll come.
Yes.
And you'll be happy when it does.
Yes. Yes, definitely. Definitely. So you overall for landscape lighting, you prefer 3,000. But you yourself like 2,700. I think people have their favorites wherever they are. And I think even vendors sometimes will give two options. And in LED, vendors are now able to offer different wattages on the same fixture. So as the tree grows or as something gets bigger and broader and a larger part of the composition, you can adjust the wattage to suit that.
Let me say something about that.
Sure.
I believe that we're designers and not artists. And so it's whatever our client wants. If our client wants 3,000, I'll do 3,000. But when LED first came out, I can remember some salesman saying, we can give you 15,000 degrees Kelvin. I'm like, what? And when I first moved here, the woman that runs our community called me up and she said, Jan, we need your help on the sign lighting that we're doing at all the entrances to the community. They've got core 10 and then they're back using backlighting to light the sign. And the signage provider wanted it to be 6,000 degrees Kelvin on core 10. I mean, it would have been horrendous. And so I called them up and I said, No. Can we please have 2,700? And they said, well, no, 6,000 is the standard. That's what everybody uses. And that's what we offer. And I said, no. Can we please have 2,700? And the guy said, well, I'll get back to you. And so he got back to me and said, we can give you 3,000. So we settled on 3,000. So I want to talk about what you said about the changes that have to occur in landscape lighting. In the third edition of my book, I'm pretty sure it's the third edition, I added a chapter called Garden Evolution. And I had learned so much about garden evolution by the time I wrote that, the third edition of the landscape lighting book, that I knew how important it was that we all needed to hear about it. There is so much change that goes on in landscape lighting. And it starts with when you first are doing a project. If I get an architectural plan from a landscape architect with all the planting showing, I know that that is not what I will be lighting because so much changes between the time they do the plans and construction. And it could be that they can't get that plant because of some storm in some area, or that plant is no longer available, or they change their mind about what plant, or they change their mind about how many plants. They might, there's all kinds of changes. They can add a whole new garden. They can change where the pathway goes. They can add a water feature or sculptures. The thing about landscape lighting is change is constant from the time you first get brought into the project forever. So we need to plan our projects to be able to respond to change. And that starts with the power infrastructure. We need to be well enough aware of what we're lighting to begin with, that we know that the California live oak or the Southern live oak that you're planting today will get to be 10 to 20 times bigger, 10 to 20 times bigger over the course of the years. And so you need to plan the size of the cables, the size of the transformer, the size of the dimming system, and the capability of the fixture to be able to change. So you either need to use a fixture that has integral dimming in the fixture, and there are fixtures that can do that now, right at the fixture, before you do the dimming of the whole scene. Or you need to be able to take out either the integral module or the replacement LED lamp and put in a new lamp. You might need to change the wattage, you might need to change the beam spread, but you're going to need to change something, and you'll probably need to add more fixtures with those two trees that I talked about over the course of the growth of that tree. So somebody needs to be taking care of it. And the way I try to set it up on my projects is I find someone locally, usually the installer, to take care of it, to do all the normal maintenance, making sure that the fixtures don't lose their aim and they're not full of debris from the garden, much less burning out, which the landscape lighting fixture lamps, the LED lamps should not burn out, but they do. So that is still an issue, although it's not a major issue like it may have been in the past.
Right.
So at some point, that person that's maintaining the landscape is going to need to call the designer back in because of so many changes. And in that chapter, I show, I think it's three projects where I was just, the first one that happened to me, I had worked on this project for years and I hadn't seen the project in a few years. And the client would always call me back every few years. So he calls me back and I think it's just a normal, I'm going to look at it and see what needs to happen. And we're standing on his deck looking at the property. And I said to him, can I have a few minutes? I've got to think about this. The entire garden had changed completely, completely. There was a new dry stream bed. There was 10 or 20 new Japanese maple trees. There was a whole new building over in one area and a fence going into another garden. I mean, it had changed so much, I really felt like I needed to start my design thinking over. And that's only one example of it. I worked on one in Bermuda where we were doing a water wall that was, the house was up on the upper level, and then there was this water level down to the pool deck level. And the water wall was kind of like one of the last things being constructed. And before it started being constructed, the landscape architect was fired. I had done my entire plan based on the planting and the pockets that were going to be in this water wall. And I had, you know, as I always do, I had designed down to the nth degree. So I get a call from the electrical contractor. He said, Jan, I'm really trying to figure out where to put the transformers in this water wall. And it's really complicated. And I just really need you to come down and look at it. And I thought, okay, I'll come look at it. And I got there and I couldn't make heads or tails of it. The guy that had built the water wall had just done whatever he felt like. There was no relationship to the drawings at all. So that was the project that taught me to never show light fixtures on a contract document. Again, I, on all my projects, no matter how big or how small, I'll have a note at a tree that says, allow for up to 5 of this type of fixture and 4 of this type of fixture on this transformer and that control load. So they can bid the project. And when we get out there, we can figure out what type of fixture we need, because who knows? We don't know. I had a third one, and I think these are the three that are in the book. Huge place. It was 300 acres, and there was this huge hillside that was built up between the main house and the lake so that you couldn't see the lake from the main house. All the big trees had been put in on this hillside one August. And I had gone through and flagged all my fixture locations. And I got called back in December because a few changes had occurred. And I got there and 90% of the trees were gone. And luckily on this property, they literally were taken up and moved to another part of the property because the owner didn't like it. And this was another time when the landscape architect got fired. She didn't like that. And so she fired him and took out all the trees. And the landscape contractor the landscape contractor was now doing the design. And I'm not saying that's a good or bad thing. He did a fabulous job, but it was a huge shock. And so what I want us to be prepared for in landscape lighting is big changes as well as normal changes, starting with the power system that we're providing so that we don't have to keep digging up the garden as things are changing.
Right. And I guess LED maybe has made that a little bit easier because the loads, the individual—
they're so much smaller. Yeah. In landscape lighting, I don't know as much about interior lighting. I haven't paid as much attention to
getting
the
change. Smaller.
Yeah. But in landscape lighting, the change from the old halogen incandescent that we used to LED is somewhere between 70 to 90% reduction. 70 to 90. That's huge.
Mm-hmm. So it's easier to, if you have a big transformer and some satellite transformers, it's easier to account for additional fixtures because you're not maxing out every spot knowing that you're gonna max them out again, you know, soon.
But it's not just even maxing out, it's all the power distribution that you'll need to do as you're making these changes. And you know, it's pretty easy to do landscape lighting power distribution because it doesn't have to be that deep, as long as you don't have to add 120 volts. So that's really the key thing. You want to make sure you get 120 volts every place you can possibly imagine in the beginning so that you can minimize digging up the garden.
That makes sense. So in an ideal world for a project, how often would you want somebody to contact you? Is there a time frame? Like, you know, so you don't get the shock where you go out and
there's always shocks.
Nothing. I guess there, yes.
There's always shocks.
With this,
yeah.
This
certainly shock. I want them to call when they're going to make a big change before they've made the change so that we can prepare for it, which so far, I'm trying to think, has anyone ever done that? I don't think anyone's ever done that.
Perfect world.
Yeah. Actually, on a couple of projects on Long Island, they have called me and said, okay, we're going to make a big change. But typically, you want the maintenance person to be checking the landscape lighting on, a new installation. You want that to be checked every few months. I would say at least 3 times a year forever because of things getting knocked out of adjustment because of animals in the garden or gardeners in the garden or you in the garden, tools in the garden, things falling out of the sky. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure you want it to be looking its best all the time. And if you have someone coming regularly, it won't be a big deal. It's a big deal when you've gone years and things have gotten out of sorts.
Right. So, and I want to go back to one thing. You talked about path lights. And so I was going to ask you, we wanted to know, is there anything that is like a no-go for you? You will not use, I will not use X.
Yeah, I will not use a path light where you can see a lens. It can be just the lens of the fixture, not even the lens of the lamp. No lenses, got to be completely shielded because anytime you can see a lens, it will distract from the design concept, from the plan that you've presented, the scene that you've presented.
Okay.
And I didn't finish when you want to call me back in. You want to call me back in when you're planning big changes or when things have grown so much that you, the owner, and the guy that's doing the maintenance or the gal that's doing the maintenance says, you know, I'm not really sure. That's the time to call me back.
Okay. That makes sense. So that you can get ahead of any issues that are forthcoming and any changes that might be happening, you can plan, you have ample time to plan for that before it actually happens. So yes, there are a lot of shocks in landscape lighting.
Yes, there are.
So what are your thoughts about the future of landscape lighting going forward with all of these things that we have to think about, like the changes in climate, how we use energy, how things break down after, like, something that you're using? Is it sustainable? Will it break down, or will it take 100 years to break down, or 500, or will it never break down? And with the sustainability and things going on, what do you think about the future of landscape lighting?
That's a big subject, but mm-hmm. let's start with the fixtures. I want a fixture that I can maintain, which means I want to be able to change the lamp when I need to. I don't want a fixture that's completely sealed and you have to throw it away when the lamp fails. That's not a good idea. You need to be able to make changes. And it's not just that at some point the lamp is going to fail and you have to throw it out. That's the worst. But at some point, there's so many changes going on in the landscape. You need to make a change to the output and the beam spread. And there's never been a project that I haven't had to do that. So we need the flexibility in fixtures to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think is a problem in our world today, we have no control over everything that's going to happen with climate change in landscape lighting. I've had the same project in the Bahamas just flooded and flooded and flooded and flooded because of big storms that have come through. But the transformers that I've used have withstood every storm that's come through. So we want to make sure that we're using good quality equipment that can withstand whatever's going to happen. And it's not just the transformers, but it's critical that the transformers do, because they control so many fixtures. But you also want the fixtures to be able to hold up. So you don't want to be buying a set of fixtures at the local box store for $25, because they will not hold up. You've got to have a good fixture. And you've got to know that the aiming mechanism, so this is the stem of the fixture and this is the head that you're going to aim somewhere, that connection has got to be strong. And often it's the stake that breaks. So you don't want to use a plastic stake or a plastic, a plastic stem or a plastic stake in the ground. And I will only use a 3-prong stake that goes into the ground because of two things. One, it's very stable, so the fixture doesn't get knocked over. It can't get knocked over. And as weak as I am, I can pick the stake up out of the ground and move it. I have to have a hammer drill in Arizona to get it back into the ground because our soil is so hard, but I can pick it up and move it. So another thing to think about in terms of sustainability is that there are so many people that are doing landscape lighting now. Irrigation companies have come into it, and now AV companies are coming into it, and they have completely different skill sets of knowledge. They don't have our skill set of knowledge, and they don't understand how deep our skill set of knowledge is. They think, oh, anybody can do landscape lighting. I'll just put a fixture here and put a fixture there. Some people don't, in these groups, don't even come back and look at the landscape lighting after they've installed it during the day, which is the most design happens during aiming. You have to go back at night. I spend more time at night on projects than I spend during the day, ever. So the problem that I see is that these people need to be educated. And, you know, we can always try and get them to go to ILLI, the International Landscape Lighting Institute's course, which is it's a master class in landscape lighting. But a lot of those people are not going to ever take that class. So we have to get them educated. And so we've got to somehow get to them. And there's just so many people that don't care. Living in Arizona, I have found more people that don't care than I can absolutely imagine. I used to think it's just the landscape architects that we have a hard time getting out to the site at night. Here, it's the landscape contractors. You can't get them to come out at night. It's just impossible. Yeah. So we've got to really work on how we're going to fix that, fix the everybody understanding and knowing so they can do a better job and not have to have me do the design. We need everybody to be able to do good design. The more people that we can get doing good design, imagine how beautiful the night of Earth can be. So I don't know how to solve that, but that I think is the biggest issue that we've got.
Is there a general certification if I am a homeowner? I mean, we understand that the commercial landscape lighting designers do it, you know, have a bit more certification, but is there a certification that if I'm looking for someone that I should be?
Oh, okay. Yeah. You want them to either have gone through the AOP Cold program or have ILLI after their name. If they have one of those, then you know that they know what they're doing.
Okay, that's good.
They're going to be the best designer, but at least they know what they're doing.
Right. The average person will just Google it and then you have 15 sponsored. So you never know what you're getting. So looking for that certification is good.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. I think we have covered a ton of territory today. We hope that we can have you on again sometime and pick your brain a little more and hear some more of your stories.
I'd be happy to. I know you have to go on to other things, but I'd be happy to come back whenever you want.
And we would love to have you. And we would love to come visit you.
Please come visit, please.
We would love to.
If we come visit, we're going to podcast there and like be able to
show you. That would be great. That'd be great.
Yeah.
We got some good places to do it from.
It's really, that desert landscape is really something else. So
it is. Yeah.
And we need to talk about getting out there and visiting you. And I can't tell you what a pleasure it's been to share some time with you after all this time. And I want to thank you so much for coming and joining us and talking about this and sharing this information. For the public and for people in our industry to learn a little bit more about the particulars and the complexity of this type of lighting and that it really needs to be a process that somebody is guiding people in. It can't you don't get anywhere near the same outcome when you're trying to do it yourself. So. We know how important it is, and I just want, I could talk to you forever, and I know Shelly can.
Thank you.
That was ecstatic. Yeah,
hours and hours of podcast. So we want to thank you so much for coming on and joining us, and we definitely want to have you on again.
Great.
And thanks everyone for listening to us today and for joining us with Jan. And we'll see you next time.